Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I have a great show for you today. My guest will be Chris Hunt from the Grace Organization, and Grace Organization is a wonderful nonprofit that is working towards sustainable food, agriculture, energy, and I'm going to let Chris tell us more about it when he comes on in a little bit. But first, I want to share a recipe with you and talk to you about some things going on in and around the news. But first, I want to just wish everybody a belated happy Thanksgiving. I was not with you last Thursday because I was celebrating Thanksgiving. But as you know, a couple days before Thanksgiving, I feed the homeless in Rufus King Park. And we did it again this year, and it was just a wonderful time. I had over 116 volunteers coming through IE Green Homestead over the weekend helping me to cook. And we cooked 37 turkeys and had about another 60 donated, made enough food for 1,000 people. We fed about 500 in the park, and food went to shelters for another 500 or so. So it was really a wonderful, wonderful day. The energy is really high when people come together, and so many parents came with their children because they're looking for opportunities to teach their children about giving back, and you never can start too young. And so we had the little kids making cards to put in little toiletry bags for people who came out to eat, and Thanksgiving cards, and it was just really, really sweet. So anyway, happy Thanksgiving to all. I'm starting to gear up again for Christmas. I can't believe who made Thanksgiving and Christmas so close together. It's really very inconvenient. I need a little more time in between. But anyway, it is what it is. So I am starting to put together a doodle document so that I can sign up volunteers for Christmas. I do a huge Coke collection as well as toys. Toys can be new or gently used. And this year, actually I started it last year, I'm asking all the women out there to go through your jewelry boxes, clean out all those earrings and bracelets and necklaces that you just never wear, polish them up, put them in a box, and donate them to I Eat Green so that I can donate them to the people who wait online patiently for a meal and for some toys and gifts that they can give to their children. So by doing that, you'll make some teenage girl very, very happy, or someone's wife or sister or whatever. So it's a great time to clean out all those things that you don't use and give them and pass them on to someone who will really, really appreciate it. So that's new this year. You can always get in touch with me at bhavani@ieatgreen.com, and I'd be happy to give you more information. Okay, so what's going on in and around the city? Lots of really great things. December 7th is the 7th annual Latke Festival, sponsored by Great Performances, and that's at the Metropolitan Pavilion in Manhattan at 6 p.m. You can go to their website for costs, or I have more information and links for all of these things on my website at ieatgreen.com. December 8th, Green Drinks is having their monthly mingle. This time it's at Pergola, which is a really cool venue on West 28th Street. And you just get to mingle with other environmental-type industrial or industry professionals. So that's from 6:30 to 9:30. They're a fun gathering. December 9th, A People's Agenda Preventing Climate Change. And this is a free event organized by Food and Water Watch up at St. John the Divine from 7 to 9 on December 9th. And it's a discussion to talk about our reliance on dirty fossil fuels and the transition to renewable energy. We'll also get updates about what's going on in Paris at the big climate summit, and also talk about divesting from fossil fuels. So it should be a really great informative evening. So if you can make it December 9th, come on out to the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. December 10th is Terra Madre Day, and that's great because next week my guest actually is the Vice President of Slow Food International. And Terra Madre Day is a celebration, is Slow Food celebration of the earth and diversity in foods and supporting food traditions. And so there's events going on all over the place. Slow Food North Shore actually is not doing our event on December 10th, but we will be doing a holiday dinner on December 15th, and we'll be talking about Terra Madre Day and the Terra Madre event, which they actually changed this year. For the last bunch of years, it's been in a convention center in Turin, and this year it's going to be taking place a month earlier so that the weather's a little warmer all over the city of Turin. So it's going to be really quite different and really exciting. So if you can make it to our Slow Food event on December 15th, it's our holiday party. It's going to be at Danielle's Kitchen in Northport. $45 for members, $50 for non-members, but it's a vegetarian feast with locally crafted beer and wine and music. So come out to that. It should be really great. Backtracking a little bit, December 11th is the Natural Gourmet Institute's weekly Friday night dinner, but this one is going to benefit Just Food, which is a great nonprofit organization that I really think so highly of. So it's going to be a locally inspired three-course menu with wine pairings, and a portion of all the proceeds goes to Just Food. So that, again, is December 11th, and you can find out more information on my website or the Just Food website. December 14th, Slow Food New York City is having their Manhattan Slur, which is really basically a happy hour. It's fun, social, informal, and this time it's going to be at Rosso Pomodoro. And every month it's somewhere different, so you really get to try some of the great restaurants in the city. December 30th, there's a free airing on PBS of Michael Pollan's documentary In Defense of Food. And this is a new screening. I have not seen this movie yet, but I've read the book, and so I expect it to be really great, just like Food, Inc. was. So December 30th, be sure to tune in at 9 p.m. on PBS. And January 22nd to the 24th, save the date for NOFA New York's Winter Conference. That is always a really wonderful, informative event. So, and also just looking ahead, March 13th is the Just Food Conference in New York City also. So save those dates. I want to share with you this new recipe that I made up this year for Thanksgiving. It was a big hit, really great. It's a vegan pumpkin cheesecake. And it's like my raw lemon raspberry cheesecake, except this time it's pumpkin, but it's not raw because I do cook the pumpkin. So I just steamed the pumpkin. It was a pumpkin that I grew in my garden, and pumpkins and all the squashes are, you know, really great because they can just stay in a cool place for most of the winter, and you can just pull them out when you need a fresh vegetable. So anyway, for the crust, it's 1 cup of macadamia nuts, 1 cup of raw almonds, 1 cup of dates, 1/2 cup of dried unsweetened coconut, 1 pinch of sea salt, and 3/4 teaspoon of ground ginger. Then for the filling, 3 cups of cashews that you soaked in water for 3 hours, 1/4 cup of lemon juice, 3 cups of steamed pumpkin. And if you don't have a pumpkin that you can steam, you can use canned pumpkin. Also, I steamed the pumpkin, and then I let it sit in a sieve for about 30 minutes just to let some of the water come out because I realized it was a little more watery than what would be in a can. 1 teaspoon cinnamon, 1/2 teaspoon ginger powder, 1/4 teaspoon ground cloves, 1/8 teaspoon allspice, 1/8 teaspoon of nutmeg, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 3/4 cup maple syrup, 3/4 cup coconut oil, 1 tablespoon of vanilla extract, and 1/2 cup of water. And then the topping is 1 cup of pecans, chopped fine, and 1/4 cup of maple syrup. So you're going to start by pulsing the macadamia nuts and the almonds in the food processor until finely chopped. Add the dates and the coconut and process that until it all is completely mixed up and starts to stick together. And just add the salt and the ginger powder at the end and mix it a little bit more. And then you're going to press that crust mixture into the bottom of a fluted tart pan with a removable bottom. And these pans are really great because when you press the crust into it and you take it out, it's fluted and looks really decorative, and it looks like it was very difficult to do, but we know it was really so easy. So that's a really nice thing. If you don't have that, you can, of course, use a cheesecake pan or something that has a removable bottom, and that will work too. So once you've put the crust into the pan. Then you're going to blend all of the filling ingredients in the food processor. And just make sure to scrape down the sides so that it all gets blended well, and just continue pulsing until it's all smooth. Then you're going to pour that filling into the tart pan and put it into the freezer for about an hour before adding the pecan topping. And then for the pecan topping, you're just going to pulse that into small pieces in the food processor. Be careful not to over-pulse it, because you don't want it to turn into flour. You really just want it to be chopped nuts. I mean, you can, if you're afraid of the food processor, you certainly can do it by hand. It's not that hard. Add the maple syrup, pulse again until mixed, and then you're just going to sprinkle that on top of the cheesecake. And then replace the cheesecake into the freezer. And remove the cheesecake about 15 to 20 minutes before serving, just so it can get a little bit softer. And then you can remove the bottom from the sides and put it on a platter, and it's just a really beautiful, beautiful presentation. So enjoy that. I love feedback. Let me know how you like it. And like that. Okay. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you Chris Hunt. He is the Special Advisor on Food and Agriculture for the GRACE Organization. And as the Special Advisor on Food and Agriculture, he provides a strategic input on the organization's efforts to build a sustainable food future. Chris has written extensively about food and agricultural issues, and his work has appeared in Civil Eats, The Huffington Post, Ecocentric, and AlterNet. His areas of interest and expertise include industrial livestock production, food waste, urban agriculture, and food systems advocacy. Chris, are you with me?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. First, can you just tell us about the GRACE organization, what your mission is and what you do?
Sure. The GRACE Communications Foundation works to build a better food future. We do this through consumer education. So we educate people about the benefits of sustainable agriculture and the problems with industrial agriculture. And then we provide people with tools and resources to make better food choices. So we do this primarily through our websites. And the main websites we have are Sustainable Table, the Eat Well Guide, the Meatrix, the Water Footprint Calculator, and the Seasonal Food Guide.
So they're all separate websites, but they're all under the umbrella of the GRACE Communications Foundation?
Exactly, yeah. And you can find all those through our main website, which is gracelinks.org.
Uh-huh. And can you break that up a little bit and tell us what those different websites do? What is the Eat Well Guide?
The Eat Well Guide is a fantastic resource. It's a directory of more than 25,000 sustainable farms, restaurants, stores, CSAs, farmers markets, and other sources of sustainable food throughout the U.S. So people can go onto this site and find sustainable food wherever they are in the U.S. We've been working on the guide for more than 12 years now, and we really feel that we've built the most comprehensive collection of sustainable food purveyors available.
Okay, so it's not a guide to actual food products. It's more of a guide to places to shop and eat?
Exactly, yes.
Uh-huh. And yeah. Is it updated on a regular basis so that you have new restaurants in there as it goes?
Yes, definitely. So over the course of the 12-plus year the guide's history, we've partnered with other organizations to provide data to us. We've done research on our own in-house. We've also solicited suggestions from users of the guide and people who are interested in sustainable agriculture, and also from some of the purveyors who are listed within. The thing that's great about the guide, too, is that we vet all the listings that are included in it, so you can be sure that they actually are providing sustainable food.
Uh-huh. And so if a restaurant is in there, that means that they actually, where they purchase their food, is also from, like, a farmer's market as opposed to a regular traditional purveyor, or no, not necessarily? What's the criteria, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, what we do is we include restaurants in the guide that make a sincere commitment to sustainability. So restaurants that source locally and sustainably whenever they can. Obviously, there's kind of a spectrum in the guide, you know, because growing conditions vary throughout the country, and the availability of access to sustainable farms varies throughout the country. So we like to sort of be inclusive in the guide and provide room for improvement of the restaurants that are listed within.
Uh-huh. So do you list if, you know, if one restaurant's organic versus another one that's not, do you say that they purchase organic versus the other, or is it just, let's say, they're all vegetarians? It's just a generic vegetarian. Now, I'm just trying to get
we have descriptions for each restaurant in the guide, and so we'll provide details like that in the description.
Uh-huh. Very cool. Very cool. And so is it just for the U.S. or is it international?
It's just for the U.S. I'd love to see it go international, but the time and effort and energy required to maintain just a U.S. database is tremendous, as you can imagine.
Yeah, I know.
And especially
I'm
with
sure
restaurants,
it is.
They change so quickly.
Yeah. I know when I've traveled, I think there's a website called Happy Cow. And that has restaurants, you know, in different cities around the world where you can find vegetarian meals. So that's that's what I was wondering if you were doing that as well. So, and what about the sustainable table? What is that?
Sustainable table is our main website about food and agriculture issues. So it basically provides consumers with a really broad overview of all the food system issues that are most important. And it also provides tips on making better food choices. So everything from the kind of questions that you want to ask a farmer to make sure that his or her product is sustainable to tips on reducing food waste.
Mm-hmm. Now, Grace has also worked on water and energy issues. Can you share with us the connection? I mean, I certainly know, but I'm sure some of my listeners would be interested. What are the connections between water and energy issues and how that relates to food and agriculture?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's one of the kind of issues that we try to bring to our audience. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to produce food. So with the industrial system that we have right now, a great deal of energy is expended on creating fertilizers, creating pesticides, fueling farm equipment, fueling the processing of food, the refrigeration of food, the transportation of food. And likewise, the production of food consumes a tremendous amount of water. So roughly 80% of the total fresh water that's consumed in the U.S. goes to agriculture. That's obviously a huge volume. And it's becoming increasingly important, I mean, especially as we face droughts in different parts of the country. So I think one of the things that we really try to do is to get consumers to recognize these resources that are embedded in their food. One of the tools we have is our water footprint calculator, which I mentioned earlier, and that allows consumers to sort of get an estimate of how much water they use, and that's both direct water use, so right from the tap, and indirect water use. Indirect water use being the water that's embedded in things like food and other consumer behaviors.
Uh-huh. Can you share with us how that works, the water footprint calculator? That sounds really intriguing, but I can't imagine how you actually would do that. You know, between showering, watering the garden, if somebody has a fountain going outside or a pool, or, you know, plus just cooking and eating. How do you calculate that?
Yeah, well, the way the calculator works is it presents the user with a series of questions. So there are about 20 questions. And again, these sort of range from everything from direct water use, so how long you take a shower, whether or not you have water-efficient appliances, and then to indirect water use. So how much energy do you consume? How much meat do you consume versus plant products? So it's really great because it gives a pretty good estimate of the water use without being, you know, completely over the top comprehensive. So it's not going to take you 3 hours to complete.
Right. Well, that's why I know food waste has been getting a lot of attention lately. And, you know, when people think about food waste, they think of just the actual food they're wasting, but they don't think about all the resources that go into creating that food. Like if you say 80% of fresh water goes into agriculture and we're wasting 40% of our food,
yep.
Think of all that water that's getting wasted.
Yeah, it's about 25% of all fresh water that's consumed in the U.S. is just thrown away as food waste. It's incredible, really. Yeah, 40% of all the food that we grow is thrown away, and consumers throw away about 25% of the food they buy, which is crazy to think about. I mean, that's like going to the grocery store, and every time you go to the grocery store, if you were to buy, you know, four bags of groceries, it would be like leaving one bag right in the parking lot every single time you go to the store.
Right, right. I know, it's so hard to use up all those leftovers all the time. You know, I know as a chef, you know, I'm creating a lot of food, and it's a challenge. I know in cities there's a great, I don't remember the website, but there's ways of people sharing leftovers. Have you heard about that?
I have, yeah. I mean, I think the exciting thing about the food waste issue is that while it's a huge problem, there are also tremendous opportunities for solving the problem, for addressing the problem. And there are solutions that are kind of cropping up across the supply chain, so everywhere from the farm all the way to the fork. And yeah, there are several websites now that that work to sort of connect people who are looking to donate food with recipients that need those donations. So for gardeners, for instance, if you're a gardener, you can go to appleharvest.org, and they connect gardeners with surplus produce with local food banks and food pantries. There are plenty of local efforts. So for instance, in New York, there's City Harvest, which works with restaurants to accept donations and give those to those in need.
Right. Right, but that's when you have lots of food. But I'm talking about there's a website. I don't remember it, but everybody, I will find out and report back to you next week on it. But there's a website that you can go onto when you're in New York City, and it only really works in a city because I'm in the suburbs and you can't go driving, you know, everywhere. But in a city, you know, where people within apartment buildings, within blocks, they, you know, share food, and even some people are co-oping and taking turns making food for each other. It's really, you know, with the use of the internet, there's so many possibilities. It's really wonderful. What has Grace been doing to address the food waste issue?
Well, the main thing we've been doing is trying to raise consumer awareness about the problem, and then also again providing people with actions they can take to reduce their own food waste. So I think, you know, what that mainly boils down to is just compelling people to buy what they need and then eat what they actually buy. So, you know, it sounds really kind of simple and stupid, but doing things as like making a grocery list, for instance, before you go shopping, making an effort to actually use up all the ingredients that you buy, making an effort to preserve foods that you have through freezing or canning if you want to get advanced, or even fermentation. Teaching people to sort of adopt root to frond cooking strategies, so making use of parts of foods that might otherwise be wasted. And then also sort of becoming aware of the issues so that ultimately pressure can be put on companies and on government to enact better policies around food waste. One of the big exciting events that we have coming up is a Feeding the 5,000 event in New York City. Feeding the 5,000 is an international campaign developed by an activist called Tristram Stewart, who's based out of the UK. And basically what it involves is taking food that will otherwise be wasted and using it to prepare huge feasts in the middle of cities to feed 5,000 people. And the idea is that
Slow Food did that in Germany. And I wanted to do that in New York. Tell me about this. So when is this?
Well, we're just kind of planning out the details, but the event will take place in the spring of 2016. The exact date hasn't been set yet, but there'll be a big announcement around that. We partnered with Feedback and with Sustainable America and the NRDC in 2014 to have the first Feeding the 5,000 event in the U.S., which is back in Oakland, California.
Uh-huh. Well, you should partner with Slow Food, too, because I know they're all over that. And
absolutely.
You know, as a Slow Food chapter leader, I know that I've really wanted to get that going in New York myself, because when I was at Terra Madre not last year, but the year, 2 years before that, there was a wonderful video demonstration or video presentation about an event that they did. I believe it was in Berlin. It was just huge, where they fed thousands and thousands of people. You know, it was kind of like rock soup, you know, and, you know, big pots, and everybody put everything in, and they made these beautiful, you know, they had tables all over the city. And people just were able to come and get food and eat. And it was all food that would have been wasted, like you said.
Yeah, it's a great event. I think it really does help highlight the scope of the issue. So I think it's not something that most people think very much about, just because, you know, it's food is so abundant. It's everywhere. But it's so cheap that that people just don't really think very much about the food they're wasting.
Right, right. One way that I think could help, I mean, you know, as Americans, we're so used to, you know, trying to shop in big box stores and getting everything for as little money as we can, you know. And most countries, people spend a lot more money of their annual weekly salary towards food. And in this country, right, we expect to spend so little of our money on food. So people have to start thinking that it's an important resource and that food is valuable and it's worth spending your money on. But then also, I think instead of shopping in such bulk and buying so much at a time, like, you know, going to Costco and buying huge quantities, I think the way that they do it in Europe, you know, they almost stop at the store on their way home when they decide they're going home, what do they want to eat, and they just pick up what they're going to eat that night. And, you know, it's done daily because I know a lot of times people shop and then their plans change and they're not home as many nights as they think they're going to be, especially if you live in the city. You know, if you have kids at home, you know, your life's a little bit more predictable. But I think so many people shop with the intention of doing all this cooking and then that doesn't happen.
Yeah. I think that's where food storage comes into play, though. But again, I think a big part of the problem is that people don't think about how much they're wasting, just don't realize it. The average family of four in the U.S. Throws out somewhere between $1,300 and $2,300 per year of food, which, you know, that's real money. Those are real potential savings.
Right.
But I think what's exciting about the issue is that it's starting to really take off. And I think people are starting to sort of hear more about the issue, thanks to the efforts of advocacy organizations, but also thanks to the efforts of the government. The USDA and EPA recently announced a joint commitment to trying to reduce U.S. food waste by 50% by 2030, which is a huge amount. But it's exciting to see that that action is actually being taken on the issue, and it's exciting too.
That would be great.
It would be.
Yeah,
and I think
also what people have to do is stop always expecting just perfect looking food. I know in Europe there's a whole campaign of the ugly fruit, you know, and the ugly vegetable, and
yeah.
You know, things come out misshapen. I mean, I know as a gardener, I grow most of my own food during the season. I'm much more forgiving with my own stuff than I would be if I went to the store, you know. I eat my apples that had, you know, little holes in it because I just cut around that and I eat them because I don't spray my apples and that's just how they are. But they're delicious.
Right.
Same with the peaches, you know. My peaches have a little fungus on them. You know, part of it gets rotten. I just cut that off. But the peaches are unbelievable. You can't buy peaches most places that taste like a peach just picked from a tree, you know. So.
Yep.
Yeah, well, you're doing great work there. I actually want to talk about the movies that you have, The Meatrix. I know you came out with a new one, but I'd like to tell people about the old one. But before we do, let's take a couple-minute break, and when we come back, let's talk about The Meatrix movies, okay?
Great.
Everyone, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. I'm talking with Chris Hunt from the Grace Communications Foundation, and you're listening to Bhavani at IE Green. Be right back.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hi, I'm Carolyn Baker. Join me Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time for the Lifeboat Hour. Formerly hosted by the late Michael Rupert, the Lifeboat Hour, now hosted by me, focuses on creating internal and external resilience to fortify us in turbulent times. Our guests, music, and call-ins make for a show that you will want to keep on your calendar and share with your friends. For the finest in resilience radio, join us at the Lifeboat Hour on Sunday nights at 9 Eastern.
This is Karen Hartglass, host of It's All About Food, and you're listening to PRN, your source for progressive, up-to-date, and inspirational information on nutrition and health.
Hi there, this is Harvey Wasserman. I am the host of the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show, which airs every Monday at 3 p.m. at PRN.FM. We cover the great issues of your health and wellness, of the health and wellness of the planet, of moving ahead towards a Solartopian, green-powered, holistic Earth. Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network, and I'm here with my guest, Chris Hunt, from the Grace Communications Foundation, and we're just about to talk about the series of movies they have called The Matrix. Chris, you with me?
Yes.
So can you tell us about these films that you have, The Matrix? What are they about? What? And I know you just relaunched a new one.
Yeah, so The Matrix is a series of animated videos that parodies the Matrix films and highlights the problems with factory farms. So the original Matrix came out in 2003, and it actually ended up being a tremendous success. So it was one of the first viral advocacy videos to be created. Went wild, crashed our servers. You know, we've had hundreds of people, contact us to screen the movie throughout the world. We've had millions of views. We've since created two additional sequels to that, and then most recently, to commemorate the 10-year anniversary of the movie, we created a new version, The Matrix Relaunched.
Uh-huh.
And basically, what the new version does is it highlights the themes of urgency and opportunity. So on the one hand, since the launch of the original Matrix, the factory farm problem has gotten worse. There are more factory farms, the factory farms are bigger, more consolidation within the industry. But on the other hand, there's great opportunity because over the course of that time, consumer awareness of the factory farm issue has risen dramatically, and people care more about where their food comes from. And more alternative options are springing up. More sustainable farms are coming into fruition. So it's really exciting from that standpoint. But again, that urgency is still there. We can't become complacent. We have to keep on promoting sustainable agriculture.
Sure. Well, actually, you know, I've recently become very aware of all the greenhouse gas emissions that come from factory farming. And, you know, I actually was talking to someone about, you know, adding a carbon tax for meat to see if that would help reduce people's intake of meat. You know, I know in Mexico they recently put on a tax for sugary sodas. And, of course, there's certainly a lot of talk about doing a carbon tax for greenhouse gas emissions from just general industry, factories. What do you think about a carbon tax for meat? I think that would get people to eat less.
I think it would be very very unlikely that the meat lobby would allow that to happen. But yeah, it'd be great to see that. And it's not just just carbon that factory farms emit. There's also a tremendous amount of pollution that goes along with industrial livestock production. So in the U.S., factory farms produce about 370 million tons of waste every year. That's 13 times more waste than is created by the human population. And where the factory farms operate is they basically store this waste in big cesspools that are open and exposed to the air. So those end up emitting air pollution. Then they also end up leaking into the surrounding soil and sometimes overflowing, which causes water pollution. So it'd be great to see a tax put on those pollutants as well.
Yeah, I know when you're flying over the U.S., you see all these big pools of waste. It's really horrible. And what other downsides do you see of factory farms do you see any solution to the factory farm dilemma?
Yeah, I mean, so the other major problems are obviously the animal welfare concerns, for sure. I mean, when you have a factory farm, you have many animals confined very closely in one place. So that compromises their ability to carry out natural behaviors. As a result of the extreme confinement, there's also elevated levels of stress and also elevated levels of disease. And one of the things that's done to sort of address the disease problem is factory farms administer non-therapeutic doses of antibiotics. So in other words, very low levels of antibiotics are given to the animals. And that's to prevent widespread disease and also to promote growth. The trouble with this is that it ends up promoting the proliferation of antibiotic-resistant bacteria. So you end up promoting the growth of bacteria that can ultimately impair human health and ultimately make the antibiotics that we use to treat humans less effective. So those are kind of two of the biggest problems. As I mentioned earlier, there's the pollution issue. So factory farms are huge polluters, and it's an industry really that's not properly regulated. I mean, if you have a factory in the U.S., for instance, you generally have to abide by a whole lot of environmental standards. If you have a factory farm, the environmental regulations are very lax and they're not very well enforced. To give another idea of the scope of the waste that I'm talking about, an average dairy cow produces about 23 times the amount of waste as a human. So if you have a dairy CAFO with a dairy factory farm with 10,000 cows, that's basically the same amount of waste as a city of a quarter of a million people, except the city would have a sewage treatment plant, whereas the factory farm would just store the waste out in this open cesspool, this manure lagoon. So obviously this has detrimental impacts on the surrounding communities too, because you have this sort of overwhelming stench of the farms, coupled with issues of disease and polluted water. All around factory farms are pretty terrible, and I would say that the solution is to get rid of them. Unfortunately, that's a little bit easier said than done, because they're very well established and they're very powerful and wealthy interests that are in the business of promoting them. However, as I mentioned earlier, there are plenty of alternatives to factory farms. There are plenty of farmers throughout the U.S. Who raise animals sustainably on pasture. Many of those farms are listed in our Eat Well guide. And there's definitely an increased consumer interest in this sort of meat and a recognition that meat and dairy products from factory farms aren't good and aren't what people are looking for.
Right. I try to encourage people any time that you go out to eat, even if you know that you're not at a restaurant where they're serving the kind of meat you want, even though you know that, always ask and say, "What do you have any meat that's raised sustainably? Do you have any meat that's antibiotic and hormone-free?" Because as we do this, the more people requesting it, people start, restaurant owners and purveyors start hearing this, and they want to meet the need. And by them meeting the need right now, like when you know, I know Chipotle, who's made a commitment to try to buy sustainably raised pork, for a while they weren't having their pork burritos because they couldn't get it. They couldn't get the sustainable pork. And so I think as more and more restaurants start demanding it and people start demanding it, more farms are going to transition over because they see that there's demand there. And, you know, we have to create the market before the people are going to transition over. So, you know, I try to encourage people anytime you're going out, you know, anytime you're ordering fish, to ask if it's wild. If you're ordering meat, ask if it's, you know, antibiotic, hormone-free, raised sustainably, all that kind of stuff. And it just helps raise consciousness across the board. We really need to do that.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
So now you've worked in sustainable food for more than a decade. And how have you seen it change over that time? Have you seen much change?
Yeah. There's been a lot of change, I think. Much of it is kind of alarming, but much of it has been really positive too. As I mentioned earlier, I think there's been a tremendous increase in consumer awareness of these issues and consumer interest in these issues. I think you're exactly right that that consumer demand really does help drive change. I think we've seen that with some of the larger corporations having started to implement better animal welfare safeguards in their supply chains. I think we see that in the proliferation of farmers markets. I mean, the number of farmers markets has increased some 300% over a 20-year period. You know, you see that in the huge spike in organic sales. So I think that's really very positive. On the other hand, I think there are certainly problems with the food system. As I mentioned, there's increased consolidation in the industry. There are more factory farms than there were before. We also see industries sort of employing tactics to limit transparency. So you know, things like the DARK Act, things like ag gag laws, really trying to prevent consumers from seeing how their food is produced. And and there's also greenwashing. So industry trying to present themselves as sustainable or environmentally friendly when they're really just doing the same old thing.
Uh-huh. And, you know, you talked about consolidation. You know, people go into these big supermarkets and they think they have all this choice. And the reality is, I think most of the food is produced by 10 major food companies. You know, they've even been buying up, you know, the small organic businesses that you think are so, you know, wonderful, and they're owned by, you know, some of the big guys.
Yeah, consolidation has definitely occurred and is continuing to occur. The consolidation in the meat industry especially is quite alarming.
Uh-huh. And what things do you have on your website that can help people decipher, you know, I guess the Eatwell Guide would be where they can shop, correct? You could find good markets there on the Eatwell Guide?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, we list farmers markets throughout the U.S., and farmers markets are a great place to go because you can talk to the farmer directly. And it also allows the farmers to sort of take home more of the profits directly as opposed to going through a middleman. But yeah, there are also CSAs on the Eatwell Guide, and there are also restaurants, as I said before, that source from local sustainable farms. So all of those are great places to look.
Right. You know, we have many farmers markets on Long Island, but there's only one that has a real commitment to being organic. And it's really interesting. I think people, you know, just like when people go to Whole Foods, they think, you know, everything at Whole Foods is healthy, and they don't realize that that's not the case, and that majority of the produce there is actually conventionally grown, not organic, at least here. In California, it might be different, but in New York, so much of the produce at Whole Foods is conventional. But people think otherwise. And I think it's the same thing when they shop there. And so when people go to farmers markets, they think everything's organic because it's being sold by a farmer, and it's not. What tips do you suggest people do to find out if people are spraying, you know, and I'm not so concerned about certification for organic. I'm more concerned about whether, you know, their agricultural practices. Do you have any tips for people as to know, you know, what farm is doing what?
Yeah, so if a farm advertises itself as organic, and or if a food is labeled as organic at the grocery store, it does have to meet the USDA's criteria for organic production, and that is third-party verified. However, if you're at the farmer's market and you know something's not labeled organic, the best way to find out about the production practices is simply to ask the farmer. So farms, you know, the organic certification is kind of a funny thing. It's not. I'd love to say that all you have to do is just look for organic, and that's always going to be the best bet. But unfortunately, that's not always necessarily the case. Some farms choose not to become organic certified just due to the expense and the additional paperwork, the additional hassles. Some, you know, especially on the livestock side, choose not to become organic because of some of the practices that they implement to protect animal welfare. So, for instance, if a farmer uses antibiotics to treat a sick animal, that animal can't be certified organic, or the milk from that animal can't be certified organic, or the eggs.
Isn't there a way of separating them for a certain amount of time and then reintroducing them as organic? Like, you know, to treat a sick animal, you can't separate it from the, you know, from the rest of them.
And then sold on a different market. It can't be It can't be considered organic.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is that you know, just because something is organic doesn't mean that it's local, and doesn't mean that it's not produced on a huge, large scale farm. So to get back to your question, I think the best way to tell about production practices is simply to ask the farmer. Unfortunately, it's not always possible to do that. You know, when you're at the farmer's market, that's pretty easy, but when you're at the grocery store, it's more complicated. I think that goes back to the issue of transparency that I was talking about before. I think on the upside, though, with all of this, I think technology is providing increasing opportunities for more transparency within the food system. So I think it'll be increasingly easy and inexpensive to provide consumers more information about food and about production practices.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I think your organization is doing is so important, because, as you said before, it really comes down to educating people, you know, getting people to become more aware so that they do their homework, so that they take that little bit of extra time to research a product, to research a restaurant, to research a market, to find out if they are, in fact, adhering to the same ethical and moral standards that, you know, one's own belief system is. And I think that's, you know, just really important. I think so often people are just, you know, what is it, ignorance is bliss, you know? They don't want to know, because it's just, because if you know, then you really are obligated to do something about it.
I think that's right.
And I think a lot of people just don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think these days people have a lot on their mind. People are busy. People are constantly bombarded with information, you know, basically every minute of the day. And it is difficult in a way to get people to care about one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, what we try to do is to make it just as easy as possible for consumers to make better food choices.
Uh-huh. And which of your websites do you think people should go to most to find out about the latest issues, or do you have petitions on your website that people can sign on to? How does that work?
Yeah, so in terms of just getting information about food and agriculture, Sustainable Table is the best place. In terms of getting updates on news that's happening, our blog is a great resource for that. Our blog is ecocentric.org, and you can check that online. But in terms of finding sustainable food, you can use the Eat Well Guide And I think there was one other, the petition issue. Yeah, so we have a take action section on the website. And we also have a separate
take action
section.
Which website do you have the take action? On the Sustainable
Table?
I'm
sorry, on the Maine Grace website. But then also on the Metrics website, we have a kind of meat-specific take action section. And there, we're kind of running an ongoing campaign where we partner with other organizations, other advocacy organizations, to highlight the campaigns that they're doing. And many of those involve signing petitions. So you can check that out.
And the Metrics film, people can go online and just watch them online, right?
I'm sorry?
They're available, or do you have to go to a screening?
Oh, the movies, yeah, they're completely free, and they're available online. And we also give copies to people who want to have screenings. So we've sent copies to teachers, faith-based organizations, college students.
Mm-hmm.
I
think I'm going to have to get a copy.
Sorry?
I said I think I'm going to have to get a copy and do a screening. How long
Absolutely,
are the movies?
Yeah.
How long are they?
They're short. They're all like in the 3 to 5 minute range. So
uh-huh.
The most recent one is 5.5 minutes.
Uh huh. Yeah, I do through my Slow Food chapter. We do a food and film feast, and our first one I actually showed. I'm not sure which Metrics I showed, but I did show one of them. And it was great. You know, one of the things that's so nice is because it's animated, it's not so disgusting. And, you're showing people this stuff right before you're going to feed them, you know, you don't want it to be really horrible, even though the information is all correct and it's there. But the graphics are a little bit more stomachable.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. It's always tricky to organize food documentary screens before eating, especially if they delve into the more unsavory aspects of the food system.
Right, right. Well, we did a vegetarian slider is what we served afterwards. So we weren't serving meat. The idea was to show people that you can get that satisfaction of a burger in a vegetarian way. And, I think that's so important. You know, and I think, you know, now more and more restaurants are serving better vegetarian food. I mean, there's so much bad vegetarian food out there that, you know, people who are meat eaters try it and they think, you know, I can't live on this. And it's really important. I tell people I have one chance to get someone to taste tofu, and it better be good. Otherwise, they're never going to go back for seconds, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so true. I mean, tofu has no flavor of its own, and it takes on whatever flavor you give it. And if, you know, you just give someone a piece of almost raw tofu, forget it. it's just not gonna hold water to what they're used to. And, they're just going to have this overall feeling that they don't like tofu, and so they could never become a vegetarian. So it's really important.
Yeah, well, I think vegetarian cooking has definitely come along. We work closely with the Mondays campaigns, which operates Meatless Monday,
uh-huh.
which basically is a public health campaign to get people to cut out meat one day a week. And on their website, they have a fantastic collection of vegetarian recipes that are all available for free.
Ah, that's great to know. Wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us before we are almost out of time? And also, if you share your contact info, if anybody wants to get in touch with you, that would be wonderful.
Sure. My email address is chris@gracelinks.org. It's GRACELINKS.org. Our website is gracelinks.org, and you can find all of our other websites through that. I thank you again for having me on the show. And I would encourage the audience to check out our site and make use of the Eat Well Guide to make better food choices, and use our site as a resource to spread the word to others as well.
Great. Well, thank you, Chris, so much for joining us. Everybody out there, have a wonderful, wonderful rest of the week, and I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.